And I'm Darren Keister. Welcome to the Green Majority. I hope everyone's having a green morning. We're having a bit of a gray morning here in Toronto. It looks more like spring, I think, than winter. But we made it through anyway, and I've managed to drag Kevin Farmer out of his bed to come and join us. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Darren.
We're going to be talking about a few things today. First of all, I'm going to have Alan Burke, who's the director of a documentary, Zapped, the buzz about mosquitoes that's going to be making its way onto the Nature of Things January 17th. And we'll talk to him right after the introduction. A little bit later, right after that, we're going to be talking to Raphael Lupin-Kein, who's one of the founders of the CanadianEnvironment.ca, which is an environmental news aggregating site. We're going to be talking to him, however, about an op-ed that he had put in the British Columbian Huffington Post called Northern Gateway is the Wrong Fight. Interesting article. We'll be talking to him about that as well then later. And then after that, we're going to come back and Kevin and I are going to toss around some news items. Kevin, there was what couple of things can people look forward to at the end of the program talking about?
Well, in particular, I'm excited about news Barack Obama is planning on hosting some sort of climate summit, and I'm not sure if this is with only national stakeholders or with international stakeholders as well. But he's showing a lot of motivation, and he's showing a lot of movement, and he's been credited for having motivation, but criticized for not having a plan. And it looks like he's taking the first steps towards building a plan. And I think that's extremely exciting news.
Absolutely. So we can look forward to that. I know also I've got an article I wanted to go over briefly as well, which is snow storms in the Middle East. Some deaths caused by it. I believe I believe it was 8, but wacky. And I know a lot of people's response was, as you were referencing earlier as well, is like that climate change models have only been predicting that for quite some time. But some people were surprised, apparently. We were not. However, we're going to go to our first interview now. We'll hear back from Kevin a little bit later. I believe I have Alan Burke on the line. Are you there, Alan?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for joining the Green Majority this morning. When I first saw just the quick brief about the documentary as well, I was very interested. I'm a huge documentary lover. Anyone who listens to the show regularly knows that
sure.
I love talking to directors and stuff.
Yeah.
But the environmental connection wasn't immediately obvious. But there definitely is one. We'll get to that in 1 second. First of all, do you want to just tell the story of how you actually came about? Because you didn't set out to make a documentary, as many of the good documentaries came about. How did you actually end up making this film?
Well, it was a secondary to set out making a documentary. I have some property up in Georgian Bay, and we have our mosquito infestation like everyone else. And I'm not so affected by them, but certainly guests that we've had there and other people are affected. And that got me curious. So in a way, it came out of that, out of a real event. As I started looking into it, I just found these creatures to be fascinating. And the more I found out about them, I guess the more I thought I wanted to share this information. There wasn't a lot of information out there. And the best way to do that was a documentary. So I began to do some research and figure it out and then put it together. Part of that also is that I wanted the film to be seen, so I wanted to pitch it to broadcasters so that it would get out there and be seen, and be seen in a popular medium like television. So I then pitched it to Nature of Things, CBC. Surprisingly, there hasn't been a film done on mosquitoes by anyone in the last little while. And now that I've finished with it, I kind of understand why. It was a difficult film to do in some ways.
A lot of zoom lenses, I imagine.
I could talk for a long time about the type of extenders we had and reversing lenses. More than that, the patience, and in particular on the technical side, the lighting and the keeping it in focus. Because as the longer you go with your focal length, the shorter your depth of field, and it takes a fair bit of light. And then on top of that, mosquitoes are not great actors. They're kind of, on one side, very kind of lethargic, kind of hang around, and all of a sudden they're full of energy and go. So to trap them and to put them, and what we had to do, to go on about this a little bit, is that we had to virtually freeze them, not kill them, but cool them way down. This is the standard way that entomologists work with mosquitoes. And then bring them out and then put them in front of our camera. We built a small plexiglass aquarium that we would put them in that we could see through, and then we'd have to film and film until they began to kind of stand on their legs and spread their wings, and then they'd be gone. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of patience. My cameraman, the main cameraman on this, Mike Ellis, is more a documentary cameraman than he is a science cameraman. So a person, he had to really, really understand them and be very patient. And then also we employed a person who's a specialist on this type of photography as well, shooting through microscopes and that type of thing.
I was going to say, speaking of actors, sure. Yeah. Who was the sucker you got in all the shots to be? But someone was being hit hundreds of times there. Was that you?
Those are my cameos.
Many of them are me.
Many of them are. Brock University helped us a lot. We had an entomologist there, Ainsley Thielman, and she gave her arm for science as well. My partner, Gene Burke, he gave her arm for science. I keep saying if people are doing films on wolves and things, they don't get eaten. there we were, putting our arms in and letting them bite away.
So one of the obvious environmental health and sure. human health aspects to this, obviously, is West Nile. I think most people, I definitely do, most people, if they haven't gotten West Nile, at least know someone that has.
Yep.
But talk a little bit about what the actual danger is, because we think of mosquitoes as a pest, but what is the actual danger to human health?
Yeah, and I can't go into, and nor was it the purpose of the film to really, it was to say how mosquitoes transmit these viruses and parasites, so I can't really go into the health aspects of West Nile and the symptoms and that type of thing. But the fact is, certain mosquitoes transmit certain viruses and parasites, and they go about that by, they're very kind of innocent, they're unwitting messengers, like don't kill the messenger in a way, but in this case maybe kill them because they can't transmit it. But their very nature is that they want blood to survive. That's how they live, that's how they feed their eggs, and then they get fertilized and hatch. So in some ways, there's not much other purpose to them beyond feeding and then generating new mosquitoes. So they're built for that, you know, and they have this tiny proboscis, which in some ways is admirable. The way it goes in, it pricks into the skin. That was part of what we were trying to do and are trying to do in the film, and people that watch it will see it, that we're trying to show how, in fact, they've adapted themselves and how they actually function. And there's something quite admirable about that. So we were trying to show those types of things, as well as how they navigate by kind of the moon and stars, how they don't actually see us but smell us, how important smell is to mosquitoes as they're attracted to us, which might explain why they go after some people and not other people as well.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the interesting environmental aspects that jumped up here was sure. the idea of biomimicry, which is something that we've talked about on the show before. It's one of my sort of pet personal issues. But biomimicry is one of the applications of it is the idea where you sort of basically, the simplified version is you learn from nature and then replicate it, because evolution has had a lot more time to work out some of these problems than we have.
See. Okay. So, I'm not familiar with that term, okay. but anyway. Yep.
Yeah, so the idea is basically is that, like, for an example I've used before was a lot of, like, deep sea diving suits have been designed to mimic shark skin.
Yeah.
They've used properties involved in the shells of sea life to actually use it as heat shields on NASA spacecraft, stuff like that. And so the idea here is, you know, people just think of mosquitoes as pests, but there is, you know, and so, like, screw it, let's just eradicate all of them.
Sure.
But you get into some of the details here about the efficiency of the needles, the drug that they use to sterilize the skin. Like,
that's right.
There's some reason. There's definitely some things we can learn from mosquitoes.
Yeah, and also it's interesting how they reacted to DDT. I mean, it really was very effective at getting rid of mosquitoes. It really got, and they are introducing it in small little places under controlled situations in Africa. But of course, it had all sorts of environmental problems. But during the time DDT was used, there's evidence that mosquitoes were actually beginning to figure out how to protect themselves from it, that their outer shell was becoming harder as they encountered DDT. So that type of thing, if that could be analyzed and figured out how that evolved, that might be of some help as well. We also found with a couple of the scientists that they were trying to figure out what it was within certain types of mosquitoes that didn't, say, you took a type that usually transmitted the malaria parasite, but why don't other ones? And so some of the they're working on what we can learn about what they don't do, and maybe figure out from there how we can stop the transmission of these diseases.
The film talks about some issues, like brings in climate change, land use, globalization, social upheaval, for instance, talking about migration and breeding. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, it really comes down to climate change, that as the situation changes, as we say, get warmer here, there's going to be a type of mosquito called the Asian tiger. It carries the dengue virus. It could well be coming up into Canada. So as climate change happens, it only makes sense. But it's kind of a hidden one. Like, people don't normally think of this. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of things that climate change, the problem with it. But one is we're creating environments now where mosquitoes that have lived in hot, wet climates in other parts of the world now perhaps will begin to migrate up into our area. So there's that type of thing. What we found when we went to Bangladesh, and you can see this in the film, is that that is fast becoming an unregulated, almost mega city. And where there were habitats for a certain type of mosquitoes, a certain type of Aedes mosquito, they're being pushed out. And those types of Aedes mosquitoes didn't really transmit any disease, but they're being pushed out by another type of Aedes mosquito, but they're being pushed out by construction and expansion, and bringing in another type of mosquito that lives inside houses, and they are the potential transmitter of dengue. So the incidence of dengue, of the virus dengue, in people is rising, and it becomes of that. And when you go to anywhere in Southeast Asia, but I can only talk about Dhaka and Bangladesh, I mean, the place is crazy. It's a pile of energy, and I mean, I think eventually in the long term, the country is going to be successful because there's so much activity and energy, but the expansion is remarkable, and this is one of the prices to be paid for it.
All right. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but the one last thing I wanted to get at here was you mentioned issues that sort of remind me of the GMO conversation about with respect to food. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how genetic modification mixes into this.
Well, again, there are certain entomologists that are trying to change the genetic balance of what mosquitoes are, and they've figured out a gene which will stop mosquitoes from transmitting disease. They now put that into a mosquito, and then the second generation down, that mosquito then carries that gene. The mosquito can have a signifier, and the eye turns green. There's a little green kind of goblet of juice coming out of it, which signifies that the gene has taken. But I mean, the arguments are the same as anywhere else. Is this a good thing? What are we going to unleash? On one hand, I mean, if it stops the spread of malaria and dengue and West Nile, you know, and there's an argument on one side that we've always fiddled around with nature. There's all sorts of, you know, vaccines and antibiotics and things, and some ways have done very good. The other side is, what are we doing? And, you know, they do fit in, mosquitoes do fit into the grand scheme of things. They're part of the food chain, you know, and other animals eat them and want them as part of their life. So how does the whole thing fit? But the arguments are very similar. They're on a minute scale when it comes to mosquitoes, but they're the same as the other arguments, you know, the pros and cons.
Mm-hmm. Having looked at this, though, would you be willing to give a personal opinion on that? Do you have a feeling about which is the greater threat, the messing around with genetics of mosquitoes or dengue and malaria?
That's a tough question.
It was intended as such.
Boy, I can only give a qualified answer on that. If it's proven in tests that genetically modifying a mosquito, and they'd have to be very good tests, if that stops the death of many people. I mean, mosquitoes, it is argued, are the greatest cause of death and disease in the world. So if you could do something to stop that, and there were no harmful repercussions, I'd be in favor of it. Yeah, I think at least the research should go on.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think one final connection I would just like to make as well, having taken a little look at the video and having looked through this and talking to you today as well, the idea that, you know, like climate change, dengue and malaria and West Nile have not, you know, it's not like they just showed up 5 minutes ago.
No, that's true.
They've been around for quite some time, and the, you know, less rich nations have been experiencing already the effects of climate change, and it's kind of not until climate change hits North America that everybody gets excited and does something about it.
I know.
And I just wanted to take a minute to kind of draw that parallel as well, that, you know, malaria and dengue have been killing people for a long time, but it's not until it gets to North America that we start to genetically modify stuff.
That I make a film on it. Yeah, I know.
Absolutely.
No, absolutely.
Well, it's not your fault.
That's how I started, you know, the conversation. It was at my back door. I was aware, you know, the Rick Mercer stuff, I was aware of what was going on, but no, it was only when it really hit me that I thought, man, something should be said about this. I just want to say that the film is about the diseases, of course, but it also, in a way, I think of it as a celebration. It is a really, I think, unique and powerful look at how these creatures work and how they function, and that some of the photography is pretty good in it.
Yeah, that was one of the things I liked, actually. Is that you don't have sort of, it's not a preachy doom is coming sort of thing. It's more of a just kind of a fun look at of an aspect of our lives we don't really think about.
A little bit of that, because it's such a deadly subject that there was a little bit of lightheartedness in the way we presented the information. information is very serious information. But also, and I just want to emphasize that there's a lot of really interesting, good photography to see how these things are so small, and to get that on a big screen is quite something.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I'm afraid that's all the time we've got, but thanks again for joining us,
Alan
Burke.
Call. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and that will be airing on the Nature of Things January the 17th at 8 p.m. Is there anywhere else, if people miss it on that date at that time, is there going to be anywhere else people can catch it?
I think Nature of Things posts their programs. I'm quite sure they do a few days after, so they can go to the Nature of Things website. It's called Zapped, the Buzz About Mosquitoes, and they can go to the website and get it, and it will be broadcast, yeah.
Absolutely.
And
thanks
if there
so
are specific requests, they could come through you to me. There's a Vimeo up there, which I just don't want it out generally, but I could actually pass that on to some people too.
Absolutely. So you can email us if you'd like. That's thegreenmajority@gmail.com.
Sure.
Thanks again for joining us, Alan.
Good. Thanks a lot.
All right. And we're going to take a music break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Green Majority. Back. I'm Darren Kasner. You're listening to The Green Majority. That's greenmajority.ca. If you want to check out any of our current or past shows, we don't have all of them up there, but we have a whole bunch of them up there. When we did our website shift, we lost part of the archive. May get back to that someday. But for now, you can listen to our newest and best content. I think the show is improving all the time. So all the best episodes are up on the website. That's greenmajority.ca. You can also contact us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. You can also contact us via Twitter if you'd like. You can send us Facebook messages. We do have a pretty good Twitter feed going out that has a constant stream pretty much of environmental news from all around the world, so you can stay up to date on all the latest happenings. That way you get them right on your data phone or whatever it is you happen to be looking on. You can also interact with us on Facebook. Facebook is where I tend to post, I think, mostly a lot of stories, but largely amusing photos and cartoons having to do with the environment. That's more of the fun aspect of it is the Facebook page. Join all of them, though. There's no reason why you can't be on all of them. Shouldn't just be on Twitter. You should be on everything. Join us on the website, add the blog, send us emails, call us, harass us, do whatever you like. We just like knowing there's people out there. So without further ado, though, we're going to go to Kevin Farmer for a minute. We've got a bunch of stories we're going to toss around today, but the first one, as you mentioned at the top of the show, was some news about Obama's climate summit. You said there wasn't a lot of details just as yet, but what have you heard so far?
Yeah, the article was a little short on specifics, but what appears to be the case is So during the campaign, Obama kept climate change in the public eye as a plank in his platform, which was very encouraging because he's been elected. He was elected with a majority of the popular vote, and he did that while talking climate change amongst other things. So. And what appears to be the case now is that his backers and major campaign contributors are pressuring him to follow through. He's stated that it's going to be one of the top three priorities of his second administration. But they're and he's pushing for a summit. I'm not sure exactly who the stakeholders are in this summit. But it seems to be that he wants to have something concrete to say towards having some sort of a plan when he does his State of the Union address, and he'll have something to say about climate change, which this is that would be revolutionary to have these states. I mean, the states until only recently were the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases. They were only overtaken by China a year or two ago. And, the States is still a significant emitter, and there's still a significant player on the world stage. So, any motion from the American administration is going to have ripple effects. It just has to. It would be – the news would just be too big. And it would also just as an added benefit, the cowardly conservatives in Canada would no longer be able to hide behind American regulations and saying, well, we're doing just as much as they are. That's what, we're not doing anymore, but we're doing just as much as the states is, as opposed to, showing actual leadership on the topic. They're just sort of hiding behind whatever the states does. And if Obama comes out with a legitimate action plan, well, then we will have no choice but to follow in suit.
Mm. My concern on that would not necessarily be that I don't think he'll follow through in it. I think that he will. My concern is more one of being one to be perceived to have be taking decisive action, and therefore sort of not go be as aggressive as could be, right? Instead of fighting for some stuff that's very progressive. That he's more, looking just at sort of how he's acted as the president over his first term. He was generally he was far more about finding a quote-unquote middle ground with the other side, which tended to be 85% what they wanted and 15% what he wanted, mm-hmm. Or what progressives wanted. Is that to be seen as someone who's taking decisive action, that action will be very measured and small. That's my biggest concern.
Well, yeah, we have to wait and see what comes out of this. And it's true that the Congress is still, in the hands of Republicans. But it's also important, they've been trounced in the presidential election twice now. And the congressional elections come up in 2 years. So we'll get sort of a moratorium or a referendum, I would suppose, on their behavior vis-a-vis working across the aisle with legislation or initiatives coming from the Democratic side. It's exactly. We do have to wait to see what the specifics are. But on the one hand, it's the fact that he has stuck to it as a campaign platform and has already announced it's one of his top three priorities in his second administration, and that he's planning on this summit. I am encouraged by this, even I can find encouragement in this. It would take a major player like the states to reinvigorate Kyoto, mm-hmm. which is really quite moribund. And the states, I believe, has leverage with China. I think they could, China. They're still the major consumer of China's goods. And if you start slapping some carbon taxes on those goods, then maybe China wants to bring its carbon intensity down, mm-hmm. as well. Not intensity. I shouldn't say intensity, but maybe wants to bring its carbon emissions down as well. And then you've got real sort of self reinforcing action on climate change, and you'll be shifting slowly into a carbon free economy.
Mm. I think this may be the one time ever when I'm more conservative in my excitement than you are, and not that you're terribly flipping out with excitement or anything, but again, just sort of coming back to the idea that I'm really, really hesitant to say. I think it's a good sign. This is a good comparison. Remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about how it was interesting that an oil CEO, I believe it was Exxon, I'll have to double check which oil company it was, but one of the CEOs for one of the major oil companies said in a press release that climate change wasn't a big deal. But the thing we were saying, well, he at least admitted it's real. Right. And it's like, well, you know, if we have to take the steps we can get. And I guess I'm that sort of excited in the same way that I was excited that a major oil industry representative made a public statement admitting that there was climate change is a step in the right direction. But it's, you know, only so much.
Yeah. So that you know, that's a classic classic issue in the climate change discourse. And that's whether to pursue adaptation or mitigation strategies. And what that CEO was saying, I forget which company he was too, but the CEO of the large oil company was saying, climate change is real, but we don't have to worry about it. We can adapt to it. And I just want to remind everyone that there's no before and after picture to climate change. We can't adapt to climate change. On the one hand, even adapting to the climate change we can already assure ourselves is coming is going to cost trillions of dollars in infrastructure. Just think of all the seawalls that are going to need to be built to keep coastal regions from flooding. But by the same token, there's no before and after picture to climate change. It's not like we have a climate today and after climate change we'll have a different climate tomorrow. What we're doing is destabilizing this planet's ability to maintain a climate. And once you get that ball rolling, it quickly becomes a monster that we can't. That's like letting the genie out of the bottle. You can't put that back in the bottle once it gathers a certain amount of momentum. So you're right. You're right to be skeptical. If he pushes adaptation strategies, then I'm quickly jumping off my bandwagon.
Yeah.
But if he's pushing for mitigation, I mean, obviously we do have to do some adaptation because we've already guaranteed ourselves a certain amount of change to the planet's climate. But you know, if he starts pursuing mitigation strategies, then you know that's a big step forward.
All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave that there for now. We'll be back to talk to Kevin a little bit later. However, now we're going to go to Raphael Lupikain, I believe. And I'm not sure if I mangled your last name. I apologize. Are you there?
Yeah, a slight mangle. It's Lupikain.
Lupikain. All right. My apologies. Now, I ended up meeting you at a Green Drinks event, which I like to mention every once in a while because those are great events. And I think anyone who lives in the Toronto area can come down and meet me or Leah or any one of our other volunteers that occasionally makes it their way down there. There are also Green Drinks events that happen all over the place. So it's a really great way to go and network and meet other like-minded folks, other like-minded professionals. Today we're going to be talking to you about, first of all, you're coming from the aspect of starting the Canadian Environment, which is the CAEN.ca, did I get that right?
Yeah, that one you got right.
And, okay, one for two ain't bad, I'll take
it.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
So, and that's like an environmental news aggregating site, and we'll get back and let you talk a little bit more about the site a little bit later. But first of all, we wanted to get you on today because you had an op-ed in the British Columbia edition, if you will, of the Huffington Post called Northern Gateway is the Wrong Fight. Just to start off, just generally, do you want to just quickly outline the article?
Sure. I mean, I think the title is, you know, it doesn't quite fit the argument. I had a long debate with myself about what the title should be, and I went with that. I think a more accurate title would probably be The Northern Gateway is the Wrong Type of Fight, I think is probably better. Mm-hmm. But basically my argument is that so the oil industry wants the Northern Gateway pipeline because they have shuttered oil that they can't get to market, and there's a serious price differential from $40 a barrel. And that is as a result of a oil glut in the U.S. Midwest, which has resulted from, one, the expanding oil sands, and two, because of increase of shale oil, tight oil that has been extracted in the U.S. And so there's a bottleneck there. And as a result of that bottleneck, the prices are too high, so they need new pipelines. And so the Northern Gateway pipeline was proposed to do that, to send oil to the West Coast, to Asia, and then there. And so that's the big battle, and that's where we've had a lot of news about it, and it's the focus of lots of campaigns, and the media's all over that story, and the public is, as they lay out in the article, is gripped by it, but I sort of took a step back and I was wondering, well, okay, well, where does this sort of fight go from here? And, you know, granted, the Northern Gateway Pipeline has a lot of negatives associated with it that is really hard to support from, you know, going through oversensitive waterways, I think something like 800. And, you know, this has all been not well monitored by the government. By DFO, they have no real idea of the impact of all that crossing, and then we have impacts on endangered species, you know, we have opposition by First Nations, there's also, you know, the threat to the pristine coast in that area, and so, you know, Gateway, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, and that's fine, but my sort of argument is that, you know, the victory here shouldn't be necessarily viewed as a blueprint to success, you know, overall. I think that there are a number of other pipeline proposals in the Canada and the U.S. that will help achieve what Gateway is aiming to achieve, that is, you know, reduce the glut of oil. And so, you know, beyond Gateway, then what happens is, there's these other fights to be had, and I just sort of think that, you know, we're going to, you know, if the groups are going to be engaged with trying to stop each one of these pipelines, it's just going to be more and more sort of fragmenting the conversation, and then the conversation is about the safety and security of pipelines, and, you know, if you have a heart attack, you don't, you know, deal with the veins, you deal with the heart, and what are the causes of that? So, then I go, so that's the sort of core piece of the argument. And
so if I can actually just stop you there, because I think that you hit the nail on the head as far as what I wanted to ask you first about, which is the idea of the whack-a-mole. You've been following this quite a bit. I've been following it as well. I don't know if your assessment will be the same as mine, but it seems to me that there's that with throughout all of these fights, whether you're talking about Gateway or Keystone or any of these other pipeline, Trans-Canada Gas Pipeline, Enbridge's Line 9, any of these, is that it seems to be not relatively that difficult to get people excited about being a part of opposition to a specific project. But when you back it up to the bigger picture, as you're saying, the heart of the problem, you don't find that there's as much traction. Do you feel that this is because of a lack of information, or if there's an aspect of people's opposition to these pipelines that is not just environmental, but also NIMBYism, as in there's, you know, the people who get excited about specific pipelines are contributed to by people who are going to live near those pipelines. And that's why it's maybe harder to get as much support on a national level for a just kind of generally, you know, opposing projects in general, as opposed to a specific pipeline. Do you get that same feeling?
I mean, yeah, when you look at the projects and what's happening, that's definitely an undercurrent. And, you know, it's not easy to get people interested in these things and, hey, to get a rally about, you know, putting a price on carbon, you know, not that maybe that's ever been tried, but, you know, that that doesn't really bring people out. There's no doubt about it. So I understand from that, you know, point of view, you got to go where the people are, and this is an aspect that, you know, it's brought the issue to the forefront of the table. But, you know, I think my sort of point was, like, let's take a step back and, you know, where does this fight actually go if we, you know, it's successful, but what, you know, what's the end result? And I just didn't see the end result being what is really needed to turn the economy around. I mean, I suppose there's an argument to be made that, you know, if there is a real progressive movement to stop the growth of pipelines, and this then forces the oil industry to recognize there's a deep disconnect between what they're trying to achieve and what the public is saying, that could turn into greater political pressure to develop solutions where, you know, this type of public anger doesn't occur, and, you know, the oil industry can go back to its business, or perhaps not its full business, but a segment of its business that doesn't, you know, bring this kind of outburst of the public. I mean, you know, in Norway, obviously, it's like, you know, the great progressive dream to talk about Norway, but, you know, they have an increasing carbon tax there and an expanding oil industry, and these two, you know, work the public understands the need for the oil and gas in the midterm, but as a society has recognized that the future is not going in that direction, and they don't have this kind of anger and opposition to the business of the oil industry. So, I mean, I think that's possible, that's viable, but I just don't think that the type of opposition that exists for Enbridge and arguably for Trans Mountain, the Kinder Morgan pipeline that's proposing to go through Burnaby too. I mean, those two pipelines, don't have as a likely chance to happen as something like Line 9, which is going to be starting off as a not a bitumen pipeline, but rather a light oil pipeline. But the fear is that it will then, through another application be turned into that, and then another way to export to the export market by either the Maritimes or through Maine. And then there's the Trans-Canada one, which haven't really been talked about much, reversing the gas pipeline, but that one is another way to again move this oil. And what's happened in the U.S., that's a whole another conversation that, Canada is not a part of, and this whole $40 price differential could easily, well, not necessarily easily, but could very well disappear if, all the projects in the U.S. go ahead, or more projects developed to move that oil, because this isn't just a Canadian problem, it's also a U.S. Midwest problem. And the opposition there to, move an oil doesn't exist like it does, on the B.C. coast and whatnot. So there's the Keystone is definitely something that's, obviously captured the attention of the U.S. population, but, there could be other projects that just don't really, capture that kind of a opposition, because it just doesn't bother people whose neighborhood it runs through. So,
speaking of that, just going to back to BC residents for a minute, we're halfway through the article approximately. You have a line here that I found very interesting. I hadn't actually seen the article you're referencing, but the line says half of BC residents who oppose Gateway would support a pipeline with better economic and environmental narrative. What aspect of that then of people's opposition, when we're looking, say, at like maybe poll numbers and that sort of thing, can we really take them at face value then that, 20, 40, 60, whatever percent of the Canadian population opposes this pipeline, that those aren't all necessarily opposing them on, I don't agree with pipelines. They're just, I just don't like this pipeline, and that they might actually agree with other pipelines. So it sort of skews, even sort of when you're on this side of it, when, from our perspective, where you're disagreeing with it on a fundamental level, like this is just the wrong direction for society type level, that when you look at people's support or support for being opposed to these projects or opposition to these projects, that it's not necessarily all of those folks are on the same team.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly true. I think that, you can only look at what's happening in BC with regards to, natural gas. There's extensive extraction in the northwest BC in the St. John's area. A lot of that is shale gas extraction with a lot of environmental negatives associated with it. And they're, ramping up pipelines and LNG proposals to ship gas out of there. And, they have there's a lot more political support, First Nation support, environmental groups. They're not as focused on that because they're focused on Gateway. And so, you can even take that argument and, it's clouding the discussion around what, the coal extraction that's going on in BC as well. There's this focus on Enbridge, but this one pipeline has just a lot of, really, bad narratives associated with it. And when you start stripping back those narratives, that population opposition, just kind of disappears. And so what does that tell us is that, when we're discussing the safety and security of pipelines, if we make them safer and more secure and we give people more money, then that opposition just isn't as strong. So
mm-hmm. Well, first question. Unfortunately, we're getting close to the end of the program. We're running out of time. I've got time for about one more question, which is that if I understood the gist of your article was that, as you were saying before, is that it's the wrong fight. One of the things we've been asking here on the show, and I'm still waiting to get a good answer. I don't know if you feel like playing devil's advocate for a moment, but I'm still looking for someone to explain to me why oil companies get subsidies, why the richest companies on the planet get money from everyday folks, and that if there is no good answer to that, why isn't that the narrative that's being pursued rather than opposing individual pipelines?
Yeah, again, that's a great question. I think you said it earlier. I mean, with regards to why there's no opposition, first, I think that again, it's one of those abstract things. You start talking about money, and you talk billions, millions, and it's just sort of this abstract number. It doesn't really, it's not a pipeline plowing through your backyard or an oil slick, covering your child on its way to work or something, or on school or something like that. And so I guess, it just doesn't have that kind of traction. And I mean, I don't want to blame NGOs or anything like that to say, oh, they should be, turning all the resources towards these larger ideological or larger narratives, when they're under pressure to perform. They have budgets, they have a certain amount of resources, and they have a certain amount of a growth mandate where they have to get their name out and get their work done, and it makes a lot of sense that they gravitate towards projects or initiatives that attract a lot of attention. So it's
really good for your donors if you can declare victory, and it's a lot more likely that they'll be able to succeed and declare victory against a specific pipeline than against the entire oil industry.
Yeah, I mean that's an element. I mean, all of these groups, would agree with us, and you look at their websites and they talk definitely about solutions. And I know that the David Suzuki Foundation, they have a counter on their website for the amount of money that the oil industry is getting in subsidies since the Harper government said that they would eventually phase these types of subsidies out, and of course there's been nothing done on that front. But yeah, I mean, why do they get all this money? Well, I guess takes money to make money, so that works for government too, I guess.
I should have booked you for the full show, because I have about six more questions I probably could ask you, but I'm afraid we're out of time. I want to just give you a minute if you want to just let people know quickly about your website and where they can contact you and check out your website.
Sure, great. Yeah, so the Canadian Environment, it's thecaen.ca, so thecaen.ca. You can go to it to get the latest Canadian environmental news every day. Myself and a team of volunteers, we publish quick sort of summaries of the top news of the day, so you can get informed and understand what's happening in your neighborhood or the entire country. And you can also find tweets from some of the top Canadian actors and blog aggregation of the main NGOs in Canada. And you can contact me through the website. We have a contact form, and we're on Twitter and Facebook, and we welcome any feedback.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Raphael.
Yeah, this is great. I'd like to come back, so we'll talk soon.
Absolutely, absolutely. All maybe right. We'll book a whole show off on trying to explain oil subsidies, but we'll have to save that for another day. All right, sounds thanks good. So much. We're going to take another quick music break right before the end of the show, and then we'll come back to talk to Kevin till the top of the hour. Stay tuned. And we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I've got Kevin Farmer here in the studio, and there was some other interesting news we wanted to toss around before we ran out of time here. The first one that grabbed my eye, I didn't actually see until this morning, but was snow in the Middle East.
Oh, yeah.
All over the Middle East.
Yeah, they've had days of snow in the Middle East extending as far south as Egypt and as far north as Turkey. A mixture of snow and rain, but the point is they've had within a couple of days as much precipitation as was predicted for the entire month or even the entire season. I can't remember which, but it's just been extravagant. And in Israel and Palestine, it's definitely been snow. And they're very, very ill-equipped for this kind of weather. They don't have materials to heat themselves. They don't have fuel sources to heat themselves with. They can't... The roads are impassable. No one's, you know, they don't have snow plows and snow tires and things like that.
And many, if not most, if I'm correct, of the deaths were actually traffic related. There was, I believe, 8 deaths.
Yeah, there was a handful of deaths. They could have been traffic related. You know, it's important to remember that on the Turkish border, at least, there's thousands and thousands of Syrian refugees that are living in camps that are just truly ill-equipped to handle a sudden plunge in temperature. You know, they're just happy to have blankets, and there probably aren't enough blankets to go around. Like, they're happy to have blankets because that's all they've got, you know, like there's no heating sources available to them.
Well, and this is where, to be, you know, completely accurate, you have to make sure to add a disclaimer saying, you know, just like with Hurricane Sandy and Katrina and all these other ones, you can't blame any individual, you know, atmospheric effect on climate change. But as a trend, if anyone's paying attention, climate change, like, you know what I mean? Like it's the sort of thing where it seems like, you know, when you're thinking about, devastation from climate change and the possibilities, you're talking about sea level rise, you know, giant tsunamis and that sort of thing. But not all of the danger is coming from, you know, massive, like, Hollywood style action movie or disaster movie effects.
Oh, no, but it's,
you know, just snow in places where people aren't prepared for the snow, either whether it be the fact that they can't heat themselves or their roads or just even their driver training isn't used to it. I mean, if you've never driven on ice before, it's freaking dangerous. It's dangerous for people here in Canada who drive on it half the year, you know.
And, you know, to say these aren't sort of Hollywood-worthy effects is not to overlook how devastating they are. I always come back to the issue of croplands and the breadbaskets of countries and the regions where they grow the majority of their food, you know, those crops are depending on a certain amount of rainfall distributed over a certain season. And, it doesn't help to have all of that rainfall on one day and drought the rest of the year. You won't grow your crops. It doesn't help to replace sort of, you know, an even distribution of precipitation with droughts and floods. And you know, when you start talking about mismatching weather patterns with the ecosystems that are sustained by them, you have to worry about our ability to grow food. And this just gets overlooked time and again. And you see these superstorms, like Superstorm Sandy, and you see instances like this aberrant weather in the Middle East, and you realize the climate change model for 20 years has been saying, you know, there's going to be an increase in the severity and the frequency of storms, and we are going to mismatch weather patterns with their ecosystems. You realize that this has been going on, for 20 years, and
the 20-year statistic is that, you know, if you consider these, if this is climate change, that's not that bad. But again, even if we stopped all CO2 production or release into the atmosphere, all the atmospheric pollutants that affect the climate stability, if you stopped every single one of them 100% today, it will still get worse for 20 years. And that's, you know, so if you consider these the very, 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 very beginning tremors of a later earthquake, they should be taken very seriously.
Well, you know, it's true that Superstorm Sandy put a bit of a dent in the American psyche regarding climate change, and a lot of activists were very disappointed with Obama that he didn't mention climate change in the wake of Superstorm Sandy. I don't know why he didn't take that opportunity to. He might have been extra sensitive to being criticized on the right for campaigning essentially or electioneering, even though he's already won the election. But you're right to say if we went to a zero carbon economy tomorrow and we shut down all greenhouse gases, we would still then need to concern ourselves with sinking the greenhouse gases that we've already emitted, because the planet right now exists in a state of thermal disequilibrium. It will continue to absorb more heat than it will radiate back into space. We've already accomplished that. It's going to warm up. It's going to keep warming up, and we not only do we have to go to zero greenhouse gas societies and civilizations, but we need to sink these other greenhouse gases.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that we're running out of time. I'm just with my last 10 seconds. I just wanted to mention that one of the other things about cycles being out of whack, and it's not, again, about how much rainfall, but it's when it happens and over what distribution, was a story about killer whales being trapped in Georgian Bay. It's not like there's never ice in Georgian Bay. It's that it was there at the wrong time.
Yeah, it wasn't there, and that's what gave the orcas access to those waters, and then the ice closed in behind them. Yeah, exactly. It just shows that the Arctic ice is melting, and it's causing disruptions in migratory patterns and other problems.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. All those stories that we talked about and lots more will be on the website afterwards, as well as links to all the features that we talked about today. You have been listening, however, to The Green Majority. I'm your host, Darren Kaster. I was joined today by Kevin Farmer. We also had a couple of guests, as I said. Links to all their work will be on the website after the show. If you want to check out the website, it's greenmajority.ca. You can also contact us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. However, for now, on behalf of ourselves, CIUT 89.5, that puts us on for the past over 5 years, and all of our wonderful community partners from coast to coast, that's all we have time for this week on The Green Majority. But thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care.